All right, welcome to Making the Argument. Before we get started, I have a very important announcement. We have a brand new deal with GoodRanchers.com. That's right. If you go into Good Ranchers and you use promo code Nick and you sign up for one of their subscriptions, you're not only going to get $15 off, but do you remember the old deal where you got 2 pounds of ground beef with each order? Well, we just upped the game. That's right. You can choose top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon now. Every single order you get on that subscription is going to come with free top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon. You get to choose which one if you use promo code Nick. And again, $15 off on top of that. That's a savings of $480 in meat by signing up for one of those subscriptions. Not to mention the fact that if you are looking for a gift for someone that is impossible to shop for, you can go on to goodranchers.com and get one of their brand new gift boxes. Now, this is a limited time only offer. It's part of their overall Black Friday special. So go on to goodranchers.com to get more details. Sign up for promo code Nick in order to get that deal, and let's get on with the show.
Because one thing I've learned is this, in politics and in combat, cowardice is contagious, but so is courage. And if you're willing to be the first person over those ramparts, you will be shocked at how many people will come with you. I'm asking you to come with me. I'm asking you to be a part of the generation that will restore the promise of this country and breathe new life into it.
Hi, this is Nick Freitas, and welcome to Making the Argument. We are on the second to the last of a 10-part series that we've been doing in the podcast, talking about issues that matter to voters here in the Virginia 7th District coming up before the 2020 election cycle, where this race will be decided on November 3rd, or at least we hope it'll be decided on November 3rd. Today, we're going to be talking about national defense and taking care of our veterans. And so there's a couple of things that we want to go over with this. The first thing that we're going to start with is our national defense and our overall foreign policy. What should the United States be doing with respect to our military, with respect to foreign engagement? What should our overall national strategy be? And I think there was a lot of wisdom among our founders where we essentially said that we desire peace with everyone, we desire trade with everyone, we'll certainly fight to protect our citizens, protect our way of life, protect our interests, but we're not the world's police force. We're not there to be involved in everybody else's internal matters. And I think when we stick to that sort of foreign policy, it actually works better, not only for the United States, but for people across the world as well. Obviously, there's going to be times where the United States must engage, sometimes militarily. Obviously, there's times when war is necessary, but it is something that we should obviously try to avoid. And one of the questions is, how do we effectively do that? And on our foreign policy side, I think it's very important to maintain not only diplomatic engagement with countries, not only focus on engagement as opposed to isolation, but we also need to understand that when we're talking about things like trade, this is one of the policies that we actually implement in order to prevent war from taking place. Because the more cultural and economic exchange that you have between peoples within countries, the better the relations tend to be as a result. So what do we do to ensure a peaceful and stable environment so that we can actually appreciate this kind of exchange and cooperation among countries? Providing for a strong national defense is absolutely critical to this. The United States military needs to ensure that we have military dominance, that we are actually allocating the funds necessary to make sure that we have the best equipped, best trained, and best provided for military in the world. When you establish that kind of dominance and that sort of military power is in the hands of a country that means well to other nations, that doesn't have any sort of territorial conquest in mind, that isn't trying to push a particular agenda which they plan to use military force to achieve, it actually makes the world a safer place. And a lot of times you'll hear people talk about how much money the U.S. government spends on our military. I think it's important to understand that when we're talking about the government, especially the federal government, providing for national defense is one of its primary responsibilities. You could argue it was one of the primary responsibilities the federal government was created in the first place. And so providing for the common defense is incredibly important and is going to require appropriate expenditure in order to make sure that we do have the best trained and equipped military in the world. But with respect to our strategy going forward, what does that mean for having troops in Iraq, having troops in Syria, having troops in Afghanistan? One of the things that I really appreciate about this administration, and I say this as a 2-time Iraq combat veteran with Army Special Forces, is that we're starting to pull troops home from Afghanistan. Because I think whereas you could have made a good argument early on for taking away the Taliban's control and taking away their power to be able to engage in terrorist activities, when you talk about the response to 9/11, I do think that there was plenty of grounds for a military response. Now, that's not to say that everything that we did was appropriate or perfect, but I certainly understand using military force in order to respond to terrorist organizations that had actively attacked the United States and killed U.S. citizens. Going forward, however, we have to look at what is within our best national security interests, and I don't think keeping troops in Afghanistan is. But that begs the question, what should we be focused on? Well, obviously, we have a lot of threats coming in, some of them asymmetrical or unconventional, some of them more conventional threats. And we always have to be prepared for those conventional threats, which is why you need a military with the proper equipment in order to engage in typical battlefield operations. But we are seeing a lot more on the asymmetrical side. This is everything from cyber warfare, terrorism, corporate espionage, which is being state-sponsored by certain countries. These are also things that our military has a role in providing defense for. And as we look at the different threats, we can kind of tell where those threats are coming from and the nature of those threats. So when we look at China, China has obviously built up their military because they want to have regional dominance within their sphere of influence. But by the same token, they've also spent a lot of time and effort focusing on what we call asymmetric strategies. And what an asymmetric strategy is when a country recognizes that it can't go toe-to-toe with another country's military, they end up allocating resources into those technologies, tactics, or procedures which are going to give them as the weaker party the best advantage in fighting a stronger adversary. And it's why you've seen China put a lot of effort with respect to their cyber capability. It's why they're looking at things like hypersonic weaponry, because if you can spend 1/10 of the cost or 1/1000th of the cost in order to take down something like an aircraft carrier, well then obviously that's a better use of their resources, and that's essentially what they've been focused on. So we need to actually make sure that our military response, our own defensive and our own offensive capability is ready to meet those challenges, which is why, from a national security budgeting standpoint, we need to put more emphasis on not only cyber defensive and offensive capabilities, but we're also going to need partnership with the private sector, because a lot of what China is doing right now with respect to their cyber capability is not directed exclusively at the U.S. military. It's directed at the U.S. economy, the power grid. It's directed at U.S. companies through the form of state-sponsored corporate espionage. These are all things that we need to be prepared for, so that as China is actually engaging in this sort of activity, we have the ability to not only adequately defend ourselves, but also engage in offensive capabilities so that China understands that we're not going to simply take a defensive posture and wait for them to hit us, that we maintain the capability of hitting them back even harder than they're hitting us. That sort of offensive capability provides a deterrent effect, which I think is very necessary toward China right now. You see similar things within the Russian government as well, although Russia has been focusing a lot on, again, its own sphere of influence within Eastern Europe and some of the breakaway republics when the Soviet Union dissolved. And so it's important to understand that our Eastern European allies, this is a wonderful opportunity to basically pull them more to within the U.S. sphere of influence. And again, that's not just done with military support, that's also done with increasing economic ties with these countries as well, and letting them know that they should be free to pursue representative government and more free market economies, because the United States military is going to work as a deterrent against Russian aggression within those regions. And then finally, we have the ever-present threat of Iran. And what's interesting in Iran right now is that many of the Middle Eastern countries, be it Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, they are all concerned about Iranian influence within that region, because Iran has dedicated a lot of time to not only launching terrorist attacks against the West, but they also launch terrorist attacks against their neighbors who are not essentially surrendering to their desire for regional hegemony. And this has also provided us an opportunity to foster not only closer relationships with us in Middle Eastern countries, but also with Israel and Arab countries, which have been traditional enemies. It's why you see some of the first substantive peace talks taking place between Israel and Arab countries in a generation. And a part of that is fueled by the fact that Iran presents a threat not only to Israel, not only to the West, but it also presents a threat to many of its neighbors. So how do we gauge our foreign policy and national defense strategy in order to achieve greater stability and peace within that region? Well, I think one of the things that we need to understand, whether it's the communist Chinese government, whether it's Putin, whether it's the mullahs and ayatollahs within Iran, is that our problem is not with the people in these countries. A lot of times it's with these dictatorial regimes, communist regimes within China. It's within you know, a theocratic regime within Iran. And then you see kind of this cronyist exchange between criminal elements and the Russian government as well, or some of the hierarchies the autocrats within Russia. And so I think, again, the more we can foster relationship with the people in these countries, that is a positive thing for the United States. One of the things that President Trump did in response to Iran shooting down one of our drones was he refused to actually engage in a military response that could have caused collateral damage with innocent Iranians. I think that was the perfect response. However, when Soleimani and the Quds force in Iran was tied to a strike on the U.S. embassy, he hit Soleimani directly. Because if there's one thing the dictatorships all around the world understand is that they don't necessarily care about their people, but they definitely care about themselves. And when they understand that the United States is going to take a very strong response and a very strong approach to dealing with dictatorial regimes, it modifies their behavior. It also sends the message to allies or potential allies within that region that we will stand by our word. Now, you contrast this with the Obama administration's policy. He wasn't getting peace deals and he wasn't getting greater regional stability, in part because he was going around apologizing for the United States. And that doesn't work when we're talking about foreign policy. You have to be able to project strength, but people also have to know that you're going to stand by your word. And so when the Obama administration is drawing red lines in the sand and then terrorists cross and he does nothing about it, it causes people to disrespect or to lose faith in the United States to actually stand by their word. So the key to our overall strategy needs to be a strong military from a conventional side, focus on the asymmetric threats that are emerging across the world, both from a terrorist component as well as state-sponsored terrorism and state-sponsored activities, which could try to flip the balance through asymmetrical strategies. We need to focus more resources on that. And then by the same token, ensure that the alliances that we do form are to mutual interest. We need to make sure that if we're going to be a part of NATO, then every NATO country actually has to abide by the agreements within NATO. It can't be something where all of our allies are depending on the United States military for their own defense. They also have to have skin in the game with respect to protecting their own borders and protecting their own interests so that we can actually work together to mutual benefit, as opposed to one side simply relying on the United States military superiority in order to protect them. Now, that's the overall national strategy that we need to take. But when it comes to things like going to war, we need a lot of reform in this area. When it comes to things like our intelligence strategy, we need reform here. And there's two areas in particular where I think this is true. One is with respect to the War Powers Act. Unfortunately, Congress has delegated a lot of its responsibility with respect to actually declaring war or sending troops into harm's way over to the executive branch. We all recognize that the executive branch needs to have the authority necessary in order to respond to imminent threats or to be able to cause limited strikes in order to protect U.S. interests. But when it comes to large-scale deployments of U.S. military overseas, a declaration of war is necessary and constitutionally mandated. And unfortunately, Congress has been all too happy to be able to abdicate its responsibility over to the executive branch. And so when a war is going well, Congress pats itself on the back for approving the funding. When it goes poorly, they simply blame it on the executive branch. I expect members of Congress to display an ounce of the courage that they expect out of our men and women before they send them overseas, and to actually have a debate to decide whether or not going to war is the appropriate course of action. And so I do think we need reform with respect to the War Powers Act. I also think we need reform on things like FISA. Obviously, we need to have a robust intelligence capability across the world. However, when we look at things like FISA, the key word there is foreign. We're not supposed to be using our own intelligence apparatus within the United States to spy on American citizens. So it's important that we write very, very clear boundaries so that we equip our intelligence community to be able to help with our part of our national security policy in order to protect the United States and our allies. But by the same token, we need to make sure that we're protecting Fourth Amendment rights of our own citizens in due process of law. And so FISA reform is very necessary if we're going to actually reform the intelligence community and do so in a way that protects civil liberties while at the same time equipping them to provide for our national defense strategy and provide for the overall security of the United States. So that's just a couple quick points on where I would see our defense policy, our foreign policy. Again, I support funding our military. I do think that there's reforms that need to take place within the budgeting process for our military. I think there's efficiencies that could be realized. One of my problems with the way that we currently allocate funds for the military is the Defense Department will come back and give a list of the things that they need and the things that they don't need, and then Congress allocates whatever they want, oftentimes based off of what sort of defense-related industries happen to be located in their districts. When it comes to national policy, this is not a jobs program. When it comes to national policy, this is about getting giving our men and women in uniform the equipment that they need in order for them to be effective, not trying to protect some industry within your congressional district. And so it's very, very important that our national security budgeting is in line with the military actually needs, not in line with, you know, other political incentives or motivations which pervert the overall budgeting process and leads to inefficiencies and our men and women in uniform not getting the equipment they want and instead getting the equipment that Congress just decides they're going to have. All right. And then on second point with respect to reform, reform the War Powers Act, reform FISA, and then we also need to, just as we're reforming any other agency within the government, the Defense Department also needs to be able to come forward and justify its budget and the spending that is going on, and we need to constantly be looking for efficiencies there as well. That's not only good for taxpayers, that's good for our men and women in uniform and our overall national defense strategy. The next thing I want to talk a little bit about is veterans issues. So one of the largest agencies with the largest budget within the United States is Veterans Administration. And I think all of us understand that we want to take care of the people that put on the uniform and defended this country. But the question is what's the most effective way to do that? And one of the things that constantly comes up is the VA. We've seen all the reports out of Phoenix. We've seen all the reports really across the country of the VA essentially failing our veterans. That's not because there aren't hardworking people at the VA. In fact, a lot of them are the whistleblowers that have actually shed light on the problems that we have within this system. And there's been a lot of movement forward and good reform under the Trump administration in order is moving in the right direction. But the problem is the way the VA is actually administered and the way it's set up in the first place. There are foundational issues with the VA that if we don't change those, we're never going to get the sort of reform that we all want to see and that our veterans deserve. So how do we go forward? Well, one of the things that I like to do, one of the examples I like to provide as a combat veteran myself, is that when I left the military, there was essentially three major benefits that I took with me. One of them was my Montgomery GI Bill. So the Montgomery GI Bill allows veterans to be able to invest or to get signing bonuses, which instead of just getting cash, they're able to put it away to spend on college. And a lot of people that go to the university after the military, this is the way they pay for it. And there's been some good changes in that well that allows a veteran to not only to be able to use the Montgomery GI Bill to pay for their own continuing education, but they can take a part of their allocated benefits and then they can give it over to their children or a spouse. This was a very good development that we saw after 9/11, the post-9/11 Montgomery GI reforms. The other benefit that most veterans love is a home mortgage. You can go out and get a zero down home mortgage, which allows a veteran to be able to purchase a house for them, their family. Again, I've used this benefit as well, and I like it very much. I thought it was easy to use and very, very effective. The third benefit is your VA medical benefits. This one I have never really used, and there's a reason for that. I don't feel like going through the bureaucracy. I don't have a VA hospital close to me. I'd rather go through insurance where I can actually have more control over who my doctor is, who our specialists are. It's better for my family. That way we can all get care through the same person instead of one of us going off in one direction. Now, that's not to say that the VA doesn't serve a valuable purpose. It's just to say that is it really serving that purpose efficiently the way it's currently constructed, or could certain reforms make it a lot better? Well, let's compare the three benefits: Montgomery GI, mortgage loan, and your healthcare benefits. What's significantly different about your Montgomery GI and your mortgage loan is that in those places you have a benefit. It's a benefit that you own that you can take anywhere you want. So the government didn't set up a mortgage company to issue the VA mortgage loan. The government didn't set up a particular federal university that you could use your Montgomery GI benefit with. No, it gave you a benefit which you could take out into the marketplace. And what ends up happening is every institution that can receive that benefit, that can receive that money, they're now competing for your patronage. They're treating you like a valued customer. They want you to come to your university because you bring dollars with you. They want you to come to your mortgage company because you bring dollars with you, right? And so they see it as a benefit to have you walk through their doors and attend their university or receive a loan from them. However, in your VA medical benefits, that's not the case, right? They don't treat you like a customer. A lot of times you're treated like a burden on an overly taxed system. And so the end result is that since you're not directly contributing to, or since you're not directly paying for your care in any given situation, or since you're forced into a certain specialist or a certain hospital, even if it's not the one that's most suited to your individual needs, you get treated like a burden. So here's my question. Why can't we take the same sort of system with Montgomery GI and your mortgage loan and apply it to VA hospitals or VA medical care? Why can't I get a benefit which I'm allowed to take anywhere? As a veteran, I shouldn't have to be worried about where I live based off of the proximity of a veteran's care facility. I should be able to take the benefit I have into the marketplace wherever I want. Now, we've already started to see some positive reforms in the form of veterans' choice. The issue is that ultimately there's still a lot of veterans that get left behind as a result of this, or the choices are still very limited. I would much like to see a process that works more closely than the Montgomery GI bill, to where when I'm in the military, I have my TRICARE health insurance, but then I can start putting money into a health savings account, just like you did with Montgomery GI. And then that benefit, I take that with me. And there's part of it is my own contribution. And then part of it is also the government's contribution as a way of essentially a benefit for your service. I think it's really important to distinguish something here. I've heard people refer to the VA benefits as this is just an entitlement program or a welfare program for veterans. No, veterans earned those medical benefits. The question is how do we put it in their hands to empower them to find the medical care that works best for them? And if the VA wasn't spending as much money as they are on infrastructure projects and specialists and doctors with an incredibly high turnover rate, and instead we're investing that directly into a benefit that the veteran could take anywhere, I think it would work out better for doctors and nurses, but it would especially work out better for our veterans who now are empowered to make choices that work best for their unique circumstances. That doesn't mean that there won't still be a role for VA in certain fields, especially ones that are very, very specifically related to combat issues, whether it be things like prosthetics, whether it be things like trauma or dealing with PTSD. But ultimately, the more power we can put into the hands of the individual veteran, the more likely they're going to be able to find care that works for them instead of something that works well for a bureaucrat or a politician in DC trying to pass bills or reforms that never really get to the fundamental issue at question here. So I want to thank you for tuning in for this segment of Making the Argument. We're going to go to some of the questions that we got from our viewers. All right, the question that we have here is from Kurt, and Kurt says that in 2019, Abigail Spanberger voted against an amendment to the NDAA, which is the National Defense Authorization Act, to require from the DOD reporting on financial costs and national security benefits for overseas military personnel, including permanent military installations and bases. So again, I have no idea why Congresswoman Spanberger voted against that. Personally, I feel that, again, when we're looking at the defense budget, they need to be able to provide reports to Congress to show that they're efficiently spending money and that we should also perceive some sort of benefit from our overseas military installations. Again, I think some of our overseas military installations are completely justified based off of our overall national security strategy, but other ones could probably do a lot better if we move them to a different location or if we just brought some more of our troops home. So I think as we look at our overseas military installations, just like any other government agency, any other government bureaucracy, it has to go through a strict budgeting process to be able to show a discernible benefit for how it's actually spending the money. We need to be able to do cost-benefit analysis. And if we can't do effective cost-benefit analysis, not only is it bad, again, for our overall national security strategy, but it could be very bad for our men and women in uniform as well as their families. So I would certainly support more scrutiny on the way that the Defense Department spends money. And again, what I want to see is money being spent in direct correlation to that, which is good for our overall national security policy and is good for our men and women in uniform and making sure that both them and their families are being taken care of. So I hope that answers your question. I want to thank everybody again who's been tuning into these, who's been sharing these. That's one of the biggest things that we would ask people to do is that, you know, obviously Congresswoman Spanberger does not want to get on a debate stage. She's refused to debate us. She finally agreed to a forum, but that's not even until October 20th. So early voting has been going on for weeks before our opponent would even get on a debate stage. And she's trying to win the entire race through negative attack ads on your computer, the negative attack ads on TV, on cable. You know, again, if I'm every bit as bad a guy as Abigail Spanberger claims I am, you would think she would relish the opportunity to get on a debate stage and actually prove it. But she doesn't want to do that. And this is a great way for us to actually provide long-form discussion about where I stand on policy issues and give people an indication on how I would vote on things. So we really encourage you, please, if you have somebody asking a question about this race, asking a question about the candidates, By all means, make sure that they hear Abigail Spanberger's side as well. But please also share these podcasts. Share the fact that we do a Facebook Live Town Hall every Tuesday at 8 p.m. because that's what this is really all about, making sure that you hear directly from me where I stand, why I stand, and what I intend to do when I get to Washington, D.C. Once again, this is Nick Freitas with Making the Argument. Thank you very much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
Once again, thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the show, again, one of the best ways you can do it is by heading over to goodranchers.com with promo code Nick. You're going to get $15 off. You sign up for one of those subscriptions and you're going to get up to $480 of free meat with that subscription. You get to pick top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, bacon. It is all up to you. Plus, if you're looking for gifts to get for the people that are impossible to shop for, goodranchers.com also has gift boxes. You need to act quick. This is part of their overall Black Friday special. So head on over to goodranchers.com, use promo code Nick, and once again, thank you for listening.